history. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years, which have played an important part in our heritage. Each show highlights a local town or event, or even a local personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. This day in history, November 25th. In 1783, after 8 years of war and the final Treaty of Paris, which ended the American Revolution, the last British soldiers leave the city of New York. In 1952, Agatha Christie's play, The Mousetrap, opens in London, the murder mystery captivating audiences with more than 20,000 performances in London's West End alone, becoming the longest-running play in history. And in 1963, Americans were mourning, watching President John F. Kennedy's funeral procession and later burial at Arlington National Cemetery. Today's guest has a very interesting and unique link to our Thanksgiving holiday. On October 3, 1789, following a resolution of Congress, President George Washington proclaimed Thursday, the 26th of November, a day of public thanksgiving and prayer devoted to the service of that great and glorious being who is the beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be. Reflecting American religious practice, presidents and congresses from the beginning of the Republic have designated days of prayer and reflection. Americans traditionally recognize the first Thanksgiving as having taken place at the Plymouth Colony in the autumn of 1621, and over the years it has been a well-recognized celebration, not only from George Washington's time, but all the way up through the Civil War when President Lincoln made it an official national holiday. So today we are talking with President George Washington. I sometimes call him the General, because he appears in uniform with a full greatcoat and sword all around the nation. Carl Kloss is a living biographer who has portrayed General Washington at venues all around the nation for the last 20 years, including Mount Rushmore, Valley Forge, and hundreds of other locations. And today we are speaking with the General. General, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We are about to celebrate Thanksgiving. Can you describe your thoughts on this celebration and how you introduced it to our society?
Well, as you indicated in reading part of the proclamation, which I made in October and set it for this actual day, actually, November the 26, 1789, the practice of having a day of thanksgiving and prayer, as we refer to it, was nothing new. It had been going on for quite some time, for centuries, actually. But the idea behind a national day of reflection, I saw it as unifying the American public in one common sentiment, and that was the gratitude for having a nation where liberty was its guiding principle. It calls us to develop a capacity for gratitude rather than selfishness. A day of thanksgiving makes you grateful for what you have and what you've been giving, the blessings of liberty that were bestowed upon our country. Gratitude implores us to deepen our self-knowledge rather than being selfish. Thanksgiving is therefore a holiday against self-satisfaction and pride.
Exactly. I think it's a great day to step back and realize how truly fortunate all of us are here in America. We have been blessed with an absolutely wonderful country, giving us many gifts and rights that many people around the world do not have. I was just looking at a bit of a history post by a gentleman named T.K. Byron, who's a assistant professor of history at Dalton State College, he made a note that in 1789, Representative Elias Boudinot from New Jersey presented a resolution requesting that Congress persuade the now President Washington to declare a Thanksgiving observance in honor of the creation of the new United States Constitution. Congress agreed and passed the resolution, creating a joint committee to make the request to the President. And then shortly afterward, you did that proclamation. It is truly a special day, and it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but here in America, we have to be especially thankful because we are a truly blessed nation, and we have been given so many gifts and resources that many other people around the world do not have. America considers you the foremost of the Founding Fathers. How do you view the accomplishments of some of the other Founding Fathers, including Hamilton, Jefferson, and Franklin?
Of course, we never use the term Founding Fathers. I believe that term was employed, as I've heard, sometime in the 20th century by name of someone by the name of Warren G. Harding. I don't think we really saw ourselves that way. We did recognize we were the founding generation, but everyone had flaws. And we were human beings like anyone else. Each person brought certain skills into the new government. And I never brought anyone into the government who I simply considered as a good friend or who thought the way I did. So I had Jefferson such as, I had men such as Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Hamilton, Adams, and others in the government, none of whom actually were on the same page with one another. As a fact, most historians believe I had the most diverse government in American history, in which none of the gentlemen on it were really in much agreement with one another on many things. And half of them absolutely did not like one another.
Well, I've certainly read that about Hamilton and Jefferson. Going along that line, I know that Alexander Hamilton was a pretty important asset on your team of advisors, both during the war and later. Tell us your thoughts on how Hamilton helped you, both during the war and even in your administration.
Well, that would take at least an hour talk, I believe. But Alex was a bright young man, of course. He was an artillery officer in the early stages of the War for Independence. I recognized his brilliance. He was recommended to me to be on my staff, and I soon realized that he had quite a bit to offer. And as the years went on, I relied on him more and more for his thinking on different issues. We kind of thought along the same lines on some things, but not on everything. So not only was he an aide-de-camp during the cause, as I gently refer to the revolution, but I eventually brought him on board during my first administration as president. Tried to keep him through the second, but he had other plans and left during my second term.
So I have read. You know, Hamilton was a brilliant man in many, many ways. I've also done research that said he wrote most of your letters when he served as aide-de-camp. Most of the communications from you or your team was done through him. Is that correct?
I would say a fair portion of them. I've never made a calculation as to what percentage he helped author, but as I said, he was a brilliant young man, and he was what I referred to Alex and others on my staff as pen men. These all had to be gentlemen who were very intelligent and extremely good at expressing themselves on paper. Mm-hmm. And Alex Hamilton certainly fit that bill. I would say one of the things he was most instrumental with, which I don't know that most people are aware of, was his literally creating the Treasury Department. And all that he did bringing the debt of the United States down. He was a brilliant young man, and I've heard rumors that we want to remove him from the $10 bill. If anybody should be on currency, and mind you, I'm not a fan of any of us being on currency, it would be Alex Hamilton.
I would agree with that 100%. I've done a lot of research on Alexander Hamilton, Colonel Hamilton, I believe he liked to be called.
Yes, and I usually refer to him as Colonel Hamilton, although, of course, post-war, he eventually became a general as well.
Yes, and a lot of people don't realize that he was the only one of what we call the founding fathers today who was not born in the original 13 colonies. So he came from the little island called Nevis in the West Indies,
yes.
And he did not have, in effect, a dog in that fight, so to speak. He didn't come from New York or Virginia or Pennsylvania or Delaware. He came as an outsider and embraced the United States and everything that liberty represented. So I think he's a fascinating character, and I'm sure he was a tremendous asset on your team. I want to talk about the cause, what we call the Revolutionary War, and I just want to ask a question. Many historians have analyzed the Revolutionary War in great detail and spoken of, quote, turning points in the conflict. What battle or series of events do you consider the most important turning point?
Well, obviously there are a number, and every place I go, people regard wherever the local battle was in their area as a turning point. Mm-hmm. And you could look at it that way. There are certainly aspects to it that were instrumental in our success. However, I would say the first and perhaps even greatest turning point was the Battle of Trenton, followed within 10 days by the Battle of Princeton. These were not major battles in the sense of large armies on the field fighting one another, but they were political turning points. They morale turning points, not just for the army, but for the nation. We were at as low a point as we could be in 76 with all the defeats we had had. The army was soon going to dissipate into nothing. As a matter of fact, before February turned around, I was down to less than 1,000 men with me after those battles.
Mm-hmm.
I had begged the army to stay on another 6 weeks so that we could attack the Hessians in Trenton, and then followed by attacking the British themselves in Princeton, which called the command, the British command, to withdraw all their forces farther north up to New York. But that was a major turning point. It was a major morale booster for the American people as well as the army, as I had said.
Yes, a highly risky but tremendously successful maneuver, and I think many historians in retrospect do now agree with you that the Battle of Trenton was a major turning point. What we're going to do here is take a short break for commercials, then we'll be back with General George Washington. This is Gene Pasale on Living History.
Do you enjoy hunting and fishing? Do you have pictures of your prize catch? Now through December, that's all you'll need to be entered in the Ram Trophy Room contest. Just go to the Ram Trophy Room at PennsWilds.com. Show off a little bit and submit your trophy picture, and you'll have a chance to win monthly prizes from Bosch, Steel, Mossy Oak, and more. And how about a grand prize from Under Armour? For official rules and more information, visit the Ram Trophy Room at PennsWilds.com.
Are you tired of looking up at that old, streaky, stained, tired, ugly roof? Tired of that ugly roof taking away from your home's curb appeal? G.P. Martini Roofing wants to solve your curb appeal woes with a new roof built with Atlas Pristine Shingles featuring Scotch Guard Protector from 3M. The only shingle with a lifetime limited warranty against algae, streaks, and stains. G.P. Martini's crews are highly trained professional installers of asphalt shingle roofs, and now with the power of of Atlas Shingles and Scotchgard Protector from 3M, GP Martini will install a roof that will provide the lasting color you choose for as long as you're in your home. Let GP Martini Roofing have a look at that nagging leak, or just call to consult about upgrading the look for your prized investment. Call them today, 610-873-1696. Whether your need is residential or commercial, GP Martini Roofing has the expertise in-house to solve your problem, or to simply make your home or office look its best. 610-873-1696. That's the number to call. 610-873-1696, and one of those GP Martini trucks will be on its way to you.
They say a family that hunts together stays together, and that's because there's a special bond that's shared when the entire family gets out in the field. Sharing adventures, memories, laughs, and savory venison dinners, it's what life's all about. And whether you get something or not, just being out there is enough.
Visit GoHuntPA.org to get your family's hunting license. Discover tasty recipes and find new hunting lands near you. GoHuntPA, a site for hunters by hunters.
This is the Talk of Chester County, 1520 WCHE.
Hi, this is Gene Pasale, and you are listening to Living History. Today, we're talking with General George Washington himself, also known as living biographer Carl Kloss. People around the Brandywine Valley probably know the general, since they may have seen him at places like the Chads Ford Historical Society's event called Chads Ford Days, or even at Valley Forge, where he's presided over ceremonies dozens and dozens of times. General, you presided over the Constitutional Convention in 1787, which gave our nation its framework for a functioning republic. A lot of people today, more than 200 years later, complain that the government is a mess. How would you describe the fledgling government at that time?
Well, of course, the reason we had the Constitutional Convention, which we didn't bill it that way initially, became known as the Constitutional Convention, was that the government was exceedingly weak. It was a more of a quasi-government. We were operating under the Articles of Confederation for the last 7 years, well, 6 years at that point. A year later after the convention, when the Constitution we proposed was adopted by enough of the states, a majority, then it would have been 7 years under the Articles of Confederation, which gave the somewhat of a government no authority to tax, and you know how much power a government has that can't tax. It couldn't raise an army or a navy. There was more of what it couldn't do than what it could do.
Yes, I've read that a gentleman named Robert Morris, who was well known to you as a financier in Philadelphia, said, "Trying to get money from the states is like preaching to the dead."
Right. The Congress, as it was referred to, it was the only part of the government. It was just a Congress was taken from the Latin of to come together. It was representatives from the various states, delegates, if you will. They had no authority to do anything on behalf of their state unless the state authorized them to do so. And the members of the under the Articles of Confederation were there more to guard the rights of their own state than they were to operate in unison with one another. So they were more concerned with the welfare of their own state, or commonwealth, as some were had dubbed themselves.
Yeah, many observers at the time considered it a collection of independent states, not truly a nation.
Right. As a matter of fact, if you go back to the Declaration of Independence in the opening line, where it has United States of America, the word united is a small case U. What the Declaration was saying, the states of America, which was capitalized, were 13 highly independent, independent sovereign nations that had come together, they had united in their opposition to tyranny, i.e. the king and his parliament.
Right.
One thing the Declaration did not do, which most Americans, I gather, think it did do, and that was to declare itself a nation or even imply nationhood. the 13 colonies now calling themselves states were really many nations that had come together against a common enemy. And that's followed all the way through with the Articles of Confederation that we were operating under in 1787. Each state saw itself as an independent nation more than a member of a unified America.
Exactly, and that's a treacherous situation to be in, because without unity you can accomplish very little. I'm going to go back to the question I mentioned earlier of turning points. I understand the Army came perilously close to complete collapse in the darkest days of Valley Forge. Did you ever consider resigning your commission?
No. Did I ever get despondent? Perhaps somewhat. I had written letters to certain relatives that the Army must either desert, disband, or starve to death.
And many
did. That's how bad things were. But I never was going to give up.
Thank God for that.
That this was a providential cause, and that it was up to Providence how things would go,
and
we had to stay the course. So I never actually considered resigning. It wasn't part of my nature, first of all. But since I believed it was a righteous cause, it was God-sanctioned, it was not my intention to be the one to give up the cause.
And we thank the good Lord for that. You returned to your plantation in Mount Vernon after the war, running a very successful farm, even a whiskey distillery. A lot of people probably not aware of that, and a pretty successful fishing operation. Did you ever think at the time, this is after the war, that you would become our first president?
No, not after the war, not immediately after. I had no desire to be involved with the government at that point. I believed I had served my time. I'd done the best I could.
Mm-hmm.
It was time for retirement.
Exactly.
I thought there was nothing better than being at Mount Vernon with a couple of friends, a glass of wine, and lambkins about me.
Exactly, and a very pleasing situation, because Mount Vernon is a very beautiful place. I have visited there myself a few times. You reluctantly accepted the presidency, and I have read you actually wanted to leave after your first term. I've read that you even wrote your resignation letter ready to submit. Is that accurate? And if that's true, what were your feelings in accepting a second term?
Yes, that's all accurate. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Washington, a couple of weeks before the first term ended, had packed up everything that could be packed except what we would need for the time that we left, that we were going to be there. She was looking forward to the end even more than I was. As far as the second term, many people prevailed upon me to stay for a second term, pointing out all the deficiencies that still existed and animosities within the first years of our governing, self-governing as a nation, the politicians who did not agree with one another on many things. They needed a unifying head, someone they all trusted, and apparently that was me. I think perhaps maybe one of the deciding factors was a lady friend. Her husband was the first mayor of Philadelphia under the Constitution, Eliza Powell.
Hmm.
She was quite an intelligent person, well-read in a lot of things, including politics. And we would go for strolls, her and her husband and I, in her garden, and discuss political situations. And it was her view that the country would fall apart without me.
Well, we probably would have, and we're all very grateful that you did decide to serve a second term. You know, when our nation was young, the young republic, people apparently came to political office to serve and then left. Today, they seem to want to remain in office indefinitely. What do you think of what today we call term limits?
Well, as far as term limits are concerned, we considered that during the convention, of course. That was not a topic that we didn't think about, that perhaps there should be a limit. There, we discussed how many years congressmen of the House of Representatives should serve, of course, and we arrived at 2 years because we regarded it as the lower house. It was more of a populist election, and there would be more members in it, and the people would change, remove their congressman if they didn't like what he was doing in the 2 years that he had. But they would also have, of course, the opportunity to reelect them. And, of course, we didn't put a limit on the Senate. We gave them six years to serve. And they would represent more the commercial class of citizens, was our thinking, and the more educated at that time.
Sure.
And so they would act as the saucer in what we called the saucer in the teacup. The hot cup of tea was the House of Representatives, and the saucer was where things got cooled off.
Exactly. I think that's a good analogy.
Take more time in deliberating things. But as far as term limits are concerned, we set a mechanism for deciding if the people wanted to do that, and that's in the Constitution.
Exactly, and it was laid out pretty clearly, and I'm glad they did all of the efforts starting in Philadelphia to create it and ratify it. One last question.
We didn't believe the Constitution was free of any imperfections, and we thought in time the people and future generations would, as I put it, decide with as much propriety on the alterations and amendments which are necessary, based on their experience with it.
Yes.
And I had written, actually, that I do not think that we, that is the framers, are more inspired, have more wisdom, or possess more virtue than those who will come after us. So I, and I believe most of my contemporaries, did not believe that we were the last word on the content of the Constitution. And that's why we set the amendment system in place.
Thank you so much. And, General, it's been a pleasure and an honor speaking with you here today, and you are the symbol of the fact that a man's spirit, his morality, his dedication to honesty and integrity are critical in government and in everything he does. Thank you, General, for joining us.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Join us next Wednesday, December 2nd, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be speaking with author Michael Newton, who has written an outstanding new book called Alexander Hamilton, The Formative Years. All of you early American Republic fans and Hamilton aficionados should really get an interesting show out of that. So, again, thank you all for joining us, and happy Thanksgiving to you all.